You're listening to According to Sam, episode 93. Hi, folks. Welcome to According to Sam. Thank you so much for listening. It's been a couple of weeks since my last podcast, and I am back. I have another really good podcast for you today. Going to pick up where I left off from the last podcast. I hope you enjoyed the last podcast and have had time to digest it. I've got a lot going on right now. Some things that are being done to increase the listenership of this podcast, some marketing and other things that I've been busy with. So in these next a few podcasts as we approach my 100th episode. It may be a couple of weeks in between getting them out, but as soon as I start putting these wheels in motion and promoting the podcast and marketing the podcast and doing some other things that I have planned, I plan on getting on a regular schedule and a time frame where you can expect a new podcast every week. Please bear with me. Again, I hope you enjoyed the last podcast and the history that I laid out. I am going to continue talking about that history. And if you haven't had an opportunity to listen to any of my past podcasts, I've been doing a series talking about the history of the people who found the New World, who came from Europe, from Spain, the Columbus expedition that they landed at Cuba is where they landed. And then Cuba was all Columbus ever knew. He went back to Europe, and then other Spanish came to Cuba, and from Cuba, Cortez founded Veracruz in Mexico. And I'm going to tell you all about that. I'm going to tell you about the people who found the New World, the Spanish, and then the people who founded the United States of America, who were English colonists, and they came some 200 years after the Spanish found the New World. I'm going to telling you the history about where these people came from, who they were, what their religions were, what they left in Europe, you know, what they found when they got here. And we started telling this history going back to the Roman Empire. And in the last episode, I started laying out the foundation for the Bishop of Rome and the beginnings of what will become the Roman Catholic Church. We talked about how the empire transitions from a pagan empire into a Roman empire, or into a Catholic empire, after Constantine the Great unites the entire empire under his rule. He had embraced Christianity, moved the capital of the Roman Empire to Constantinople. Well, he called the city Constantinople. It's actually Byzantium, which is present-day Istanbul in Turkey. And he left behind a very vulnerable eastern part of the Roman Empire. We're going to talk about what happened. I mean, western. He left behind a very vulnerable western part of the empire. The capital he had moved to the east into Byzantium. And we're going to talk about what happened to that western part of the empire. In the past episode, we laid the foundations for the Bishop of Rome and what would become the Roman Catholic Church, because the Roman Catholic Church is going to play a very influential part in what happens to the Western part of the empire. And if you haven't listened to any of those past episodes, you can do so by going to the website. That's according to Sam with the number 2.com. According to Sam with the number 2.com, you'll find the show archive there. And with that, let's get into today's show. Interesting story that is taking place in the United States of America that broke last week. And this story has been going on for a while, but it relates right with what I was telling you in the last episode, and it deals with the Roman Catholic Church and the Roman Catholic Church's relationship with power and powerful people. This is the story of the U.S. bishops meeting to determine if they will deny communion to American politicians, Catholic politicians who support abortion. Take a listen to this first clip.
While President Biden has focused on global issues this week, there's another battle that could directly affect the church-going president. The debate centers around whether Roman Catholic
church-going president. They try to make Joe Biden seem so pious. It's hilarious.
Affect the church-going president. The debate centers around whether Roman Catholic politicians who also support abortion rights should be allowed to receive communion. A decision would not only affect President Biden, others like Nancy Pelosi, our House Speaker, is also Catholic. Ed O'Keefe reports on this complicated.
So all of these Catholic members of Congress got together and wrote this letter, saying that, we're Catholic and, we believe in all this stuff that's not Catholic and we're still Catholic. And they got together to rebuke this move by the American bishops. And we explained what bishops were in the last podcast. If you haven't listened to that podcast again, you should go listen to that podcast. Because moving forward in this history, the Catholic Church, again, is going to play a prominent role. And I have to tell you all of this stuff about the Catholic Church. And again, I am not anti-Catholic. I'm pro-truth. And I have to tell you the truth. It'd be impossible for me to tell you the story and the history of the founding of the New World and the founding of the of America without telling you about the Catholic Church and the Roman Catholic Church's relationship to what would become the nation states of Europe. Here's more of this clip about the bishops here in the United States.
Whether in Washington, his home state of Delaware, or even in England this past weekend, one thing is constant. President Biden heads to Catholic Mass.
Mr. President, how's that church?
But the president's faith is under a new spotlight this week as the nation's more than 200 Catholic bishops gather virtually. Among the topics to be discussed, whether high-profile Catholic politicians should be denied communion if they support abortion rights. CBS News Papal and Vatican contributor Monsignor Anthony Figueredo says the Catholic Church's opposition to abortion is clear.
And even Pope Francis, he has called it an abomination.
It's been clear. I mean, that's the thing. Nobody forces any of these guys to be Catholic. It's just like me saying that I'm a vegetarian. And then I sit down and I eat a big steak for dinner every night. I mean, I'm not a vegetarian, really. and if you say that you're Catholic and you don't believe in anything that the Catholics believe in, but Joe Biden says, well, I'm against abortion, but I just think that it should be available for people who do want to get an abortion. That's what he says. And what? But these bishops, these 200 or so bishops in the United States of America, they're asserting themselves, and they're basically saying that, because we are a group of bishops here in the United States of America, we are going to look at this and maybe have this as a policy. And it's really interesting. They actually did meet and they did vote to clarify the fact that that they're against abortion, and not just the politicians, but whoever. I mean, if you call yourself a Catholic and you support abortion, they're saying that you should not have communion. And this is their thing. I'm not Catholic. This is their thing. This is their thing. And nobody forces you to be Catholic either. If you're Catholic, then you have to believe in what Catholics believe in. That's just, I mean, so there's pushback from the Vatican. It's so people are saying that, and I love the people, separation of church and state. You obviously have no idea what separation of church and state is. I talked about that in two podcasts ago. This is not a relationship between church and state. Joe Biden brandishing his faith every minute that he gets, you know, going to mass for the cameras and all of that. That's a relationship of church and state. The fact that that he is selling himself as this pious Catholic president, that's a relationship of church and state. The fact that the bishops who are acting independently of the state, they're not saying this is a state policy. They're saying this is a Catholic policy. And Joe Biden, as a head of state, he can be president of the United States. He doesn't have to be Catholic. But if he's Catholic, this is what Catholics believe. But there's pushback from the Vatican. And take a listen to this clip about the Vatican warning.
So some Catholic bishops in conflict over whether politicians who support abortion rights should be denied communion.
A proposed policy could affect President Biden, who's just the second Catholic president of the United States.
This week, some local bishops responding. 12 News reporter Alexandra Leslie tells us this is after a warning from the Vatican.
Right. The head of the Vatican's Congregation for the Doctrine of Faith, or CDF, put out the warning. He's urging U.S. bishops to proceed with caution in their discussions before going forward with a potential plan to form some kind of national policy about this. And the May 7th letter was addressed to the president of the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops. Cardinal Luis Ladaria says any new statement shouldn't be limited to just Catholic political leaders, but all church-going Catholics.
So basically, that's what the Vatican, this guy from the Vatican, is warning them about, that whatever policy that you come up with, it has to apply to everyone, not just the, and that's fair. I get it. And that's just what I just said. You know, it doesn't matter if you're a politician or not. If you believe in abortion, you're not Catholic.
And any kind of policy requires, quote, dialogue in two stages, first among the bishops themselves and the Catholic pro-choice politicians within their jurisdictions. Now, locally, Bishop Thomas Tobin responded to the message on Twitter, writing, quote, while the CDF letter on the U.S. bishop study of the reception of Holy Communion offers some guidance, it would also be helpful if the CDF would again remind Catholic politicians that it is morally inadmissible for any Catholic leader to support, promote, and fund abortions. The U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops is convening for a national meeting on June 16th when it plans on a vote to draft document on this communion issue. Live in studio, Alexandra Leslie, 12.
So they did meet on June 16th and they did vote to draft these documents. And this is going to be interesting because even within these 200 Catholic bishops, they don't all agree. I mean, I think here it says right here in this clip.
The bishop's focus will be on whether to draft an official document clarifying the church's position on receiving the sacrament of communion.
Sometimes the church has really failed on making the church's teaching known and understood.
Catholic Church policy says that any parishioner in good standing can receive communion at Mass. But bishops are divided over whether a vocal political supporter of abortion rights qualifies. The president has said he's personally opposed to abortion, but in 2019 dropped his long-standing opposition to federal funding for abortion procedures.
But circumstances have changed.
The decision to give communion is still up to each of the countries.
Circumstances have changed. What's changed, Joe Biden?
The procedures.
But circumstances have changed.
You want to be president. That's what's changed. Circumstances have changed. You want that nomination.
Washington's Cardinal Wilton Gregory says he plans to give communion to the president.
All right, let's go back here because I just talked over that, because they're going to say here that the decision comes down to each individual bishop. And we explained what a bishop was in the last episode. But each of these bishops, you know, has their own policy, and some of them are planning to give communion to politicians that support or who are vocal about their support of abortion, and some of them say that they're not. I don't know what they're going to do when they hash this all out in November, but take a listen to this clip again.
The decision to give communion is still up to each of the country's more than 200 diocesan bishops. Washington's Cardinal Wilton Gregory says he plans to give communion to the president.
I'm most grateful to our Holy Father, Pope Francis, for his trust that he's placed in me.
But the incoming Bishop of Wilmington, Delaware, the president's home diocese, hasn't said what he would do. San Francisco's Archbishop Salvador Corleone, one of the most vocal critics of politicians who support abortion rights, will be part of this week's discussions. But he says they're not only about abortion.
Helping people return to the Holy Eucharist, understanding what it is and appreciating the gift, and that they're living their life in a way that is coherent with what it means to receive Holy Communion.
Corleone says he wouldn't give President Biden communion, in part because the president's publicly at odds with an issue the church considers very important.
We praise where we can, but we need to correct where we need to correct.
This is the Bishop of San Francisco saying that he wouldn't give Biden communion. The Bishop of Washington, D.C. says that he would give him communion. Here's another.
But others disagree. San Diego Bishop Robert McElroy wrote last month that weaponizing the Eucharist will bring the terrible partisan divisions that have plagued our nation into the very act of worship.
Lift up your hearts.
Polls show church membership has steadily declined over the years. And Catholic University's Kurt Martins says public debate over Mr. Biden's faith could be harmful.
If you single out a president or any Catholic politician, you're blowing up bridges. A dialogue is much better.
Yeah, what's that dialogue going to go like? How's that going to go? Who's going to compromise? And it's funny that he's saying we need to have a dialogue. It could be consequential because, you know, people are leaving the church. You know, if we want to attract more people to the church, we should be more flexible. And, you know, there's a lot of Catholics who are not flexible. They don't agree with that. And the polls show it. A lot of Catholics agree with denying communion to anyone who is outside of the teaching of the Catholic Church. And a lot of these hardline, and I don't even want to call them hardline, I mean, they're Catholics. They believe in what Catholics believe, and they don't think that people who don't believe what Catholics believe should be given communion. But a lot of these Catholics are looking back through the history of the Catholic Church, and they're looking for precedent for this. And I know there's hundreds of different examples of the Catholic Church in a 1600 year tug of war with European monarchs, people in power all over the world. And there's many precedents, but the one they're really latching on to is this story that takes us back to the 4th century between a Roman emperor by the name of Theodosius and a bishop of Milan by the name of Ambrose. And I'll tell you all about that here in a moment, but let's get back into the history that we were talking about in the last couple of podcasts. We found ourselves in the 4th century. If you remember, Constantine had embraced Christianity, united the empire, moved the capital of the empire to the eastern part of the empire. And when he moves, he takes everything with him. You know, all of the people who understood civil society, all the resources, everything, the military, everything comes east with Constantine to the new royal city that he builds there. And again, that leaves the western part of the empire vulnerable. And a lot of the problems that Rome had experienced in the third century crisis, which Diocletian and others, even before Diocletian, they started to repair. One of the most significant are the borders and securing the borders from the Goths and German barbarians that were crossing into the Roman territory. That had been stabilized under Diocletian and even so under Constantine. But after Constantine dies, his sons take control of the empire, and he had kind of, before he died, separated his sons throughout the empire to kind of correspond with the regions of Diocletian's tetrarchy, and he made them all Caesars. He made Constantine the second, his eldest son, the Caesar in Gaul, which is present-day France, and I think Spain was also part of Constantine's empire. And then you also had his youngest son, Constance. He had Italy and all of that area. And then Constantine's second son was a guy by the name of Constantius. And Constantius had the most eastern part of the empire. These sons and family members start warring with one another to seize control, and you just end up with two sons controlling two parts of the empire, the western part and the eastern part. You can really start seeing the empires, the different parts of the empire, the east and the west, taking dramatically different turns from that period on. The eastern part of the empire goes on for another 1400 years. Well, no. For another 1,000 years, the eastern part of the empire goes into the 15th century. And then the western part of the empire, we're going to talk about what happens over there. So we have these two brothers. One is in control of the eastern part of the empire. One is in control of the west. And then a usurper actually kills the youngest son or the youngest brother in the west, Constance, and then Constantius marches to take on the usurper, and he kills him, and then the entire empire is united again under Constantius. And then Constantius, one of Constantine's nephews named Julian the Apostate, is made emperor, and he becomes emperor after Constantius, and he is the last emperor in the Constantine dynasty. Now, the religious aspects of all of this, let's get into it. Constantius, he was a Christian, but he was an Arian. Now, you remember Arianism, right? That Arianism was this idea that God created Jesus. He was the first of God's creation, and God incarnated Jesus. And the Nicene Creed, which was called by Constantine to hash out this heresy, said, no, we believe in one God, and that was the Nicene Creed. Well, this idea of Arianism didn't go away after the Council of Nicaea. And like I told you, that Arianism was even prevalent in the Roman court for a long time. But this guy, Julian the Apostate, they called him, who became emperor after Constantius, he was a pagan. And he actually tries to turn the empire back to paganism, and after Julian, it was impossible to turn back the clock and to turn the empire into a pagan empire again. After Julian, the empire was 100% Christian at that point. Not everybody in the empire was Christian, and not everybody was the same type of Christian. Some of these Christians were Arians, but the empire was without doubt, without any doubt, a Christian empire after Julian. So what happens after Julian? After Julian dies with his army in the east, his army declares one of his generals to be emperor. And then that guy, Valentinian, he basically divides the empire into two, the eastern and western part of the empire. Valentinian, instead of staying in the east where the new capital was and, the most important part of the empire, the empire that had the most going on at that period of time. Instead of Valentinian, who is the, Augustus, instead of him staying in the east, he makes his brother Valens the emperor in the east, and then Valentinian, he goes to the western part of the empire. And then Valens ends up fighting the great battle of Adrianople, and this is a battle between the Roman Empire and the Goths. He's actually killed in that battle. His brother Valentinian had already died, and his nephew Gratian was in charge of the empire during the Battle of Adrianople. And then after that, Theodosius becomes emperor. Let me play this clip. Let's listen to this clip a little bit about Theodosius, and then we'll talk more.
On January 19th, 379, Theodosius I became emperor of the Eastern Roman Empire. Divided for the first time under Emperor Diocletian in 285, the empire had been in decline since the early 3rd century and was now facing threats on all sides. But more than the forces on the outside, the classical Roman Empire was about to be overtaken by an unseen force more potent than any political power in the ancient world.
So we're talking from, so Julian the Apostate tries to return the empire to paganism, and he actually builds pagan temples. He makes a real effort to return the empire to paganism. And then just a few years after Julian, when Theodosius becomes emperor, Theodosius is a diehard Christian. So I just wanted to say that.
Unseen force more potent than any political power in the ancient world. Christianity. Historians usually recognize Theodosius's predecessor, Constantine the Great, as the first, quote, Christian emperor of Rome. But under Constantine in the early 4th century, Christianity was merely legalized. So, in other words, you could now be a Christian and no longer fear being fed to lions or burned as a human torch, as was common in the pre-Christian empire. Theodosius took the next step. He declared Christianity the official, unquestioned religion of the empire in 381. His jurisdiction only extended to the Eastern Empire at this time, which made up most of Greece, parts of Turkey, and sections of the Lower Near East. But in 392, he gained control of the Western Empire and reunited East and West.
So, understand what's going on here. The empire was split into two before Constantine. Constantine fights Licinius and then unites the entire empire under him. It's a Christian empire. He leaves it to his sons. It's split up again. And then his sons end up fighting each other. And then the entire empire is united again under one of his sons, Constantius. And then Constantius ends up leaving it to the entire empire to Julian. Julian the Apostate tries to turn the empire back to paganism. Julian dies in battle with his army. The army declares Valentinian the new emperor. Valentinian splits the empire again between he and his brother Valens. And then Theodosius becomes emperor after Valens is killed in the Battle of Adrianople. And then Theodosius ends up marching into the western part of the empire to take on a usurper. And then the entire empire is again under one ruler, and that ruler is Theodosius the Great, Christian.
But in 392, he gained control of the Western Empire and reunited East and West. Rome's absolute rule over the known world briefly resumed. Christianity spread all throughout the empire in a matter of decades, from the deserts in the Near East to the furthest reaches of northern Britain in the West. Theodosius died in 395, and less than a century later, the Roman Empire died with him.
So we're going to definitely talk about that century. I'm just going to touch on some things that happened in that century between the death of Theodosius and the last Roman emperor in the West. But before we do that, I want to tell you this story about Ambrose and Theodosius. So you remember I was telling you in the last podcast about the Pope Damicus. Damicus becomes Pope in 366. I don't even want to call him Pope. He becomes Bishop of Rome, because that is the title, the seat, the Bishop of Rome. And there was a succession battle between Damicus and another candidate. And then at this time, there wasn't any, what do they call those cardinals that elect the Pope? Council of Cardinals, I think it is. But there was none of that stuff in the fourth century. Basically, the bishops who were in the area of Italy would get together and they would decide who was going to be the bishop of Rome. And there was a dispute between Damicus and another candidate, and the authorities were called in. It was this big riot. A bunch of people were killed, and Damicus becomes the Bishop of Rome. And he really starts to, you know, assert the Bishop of Rome as this important position. And I told you all the things that Damicus did. Well, there were bishops all over the empire that would have been equal in importance to the Bishop of Rome at this time, and some of them even more influential and more important. And one of these bishops was the Bishop of Milan at this time, and his name was Ambrose. And Ambrose is one of the great church fathers. He converted Augustine, Saint Augustine, to the Catholic Church. He was well respected by all of the church leaders at this time. And take a listen to this clip. This is a clip about who Ambrose was, and then we'll talk more about what happened between Ambrose and the Emperor Theodosius.
On December 7th, 374, there was actually a bit of a controversial moment in the city of Milan in modern-day Italy. You see, the Arian controversy after the Council of Nicaea was still going pretty hot. Different emperors supported different sides, sometimes tried to find a middle way, but in all of this, it was very complex. Well, the predecessor to Ambrose was actually an Arian himself, and quite a staunch one, in fact. And when he died, when it came time to elect his successor, there arose a bit of a ruckus in the city because the people there, at least according to tradition, wanted to do away with the Arian controversy.
And so, do you understand what I'm telling you? I'm telling you that this Arian heresy, man, it died hard. It was still around in high places well into the end of the 4th century and beyond. We're going to talk about the barbarians here in a moment, and a lot of these barbarian tribes that were coming over the Rhine and Danube, these German tribes who had traditionally been involved in German paganism, pantheistic paganism. They were embracing Christianity, but they were embracing Arianism. They weren't embracing the Nicene Creed form of Catholicism and of Christianity. And this was what was going on. So you have in 366 this dispute over in Rome, the Bishop of Rome, and factions forming and a riot and people dying. This is happening in Rome, and this dispute over the Bishop of Rome and who's going to be the Bishop of Rome. I mean, this is the first of many, 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 many disputes of popes and anti-popes. You know, even today we have two living popes. There's periods of time where there's actually three popes at a time. You know, this idea of because the position of pope becomes a very, just like you see it today, very powerful position, and people murdered to get people who they wanted on that seat of Saint Peter. And there's the history books are so full of these stories, and I'm going to tell you some of them. So this is what was going on in Milan. The predecessor of Ambrose is dead. He was an Arian, and there's factions. People are supporting one candidate, and the others are supporting another, and it's actually getting tense. And take a listen to what Ambrose does.
There arose a bit of a ruckus in the city because the people there, at least according to tradition, wanted to do away with the Arian controversy. And so through a variety of different circumstances, we are told that the crowd acclaimed Ambrose as the man they wanted to be the next bishop. He, of course, demurred, but eventually was, you might say, cajoled into accepting the post. Now, Ambrose was a wealthy man. He came from a noble family, but to his credit, he gave away all of his wealth to the poor, and though he was uneducated in theology, he was well-educated in other disciplines, notably rhetoric and the classics. So Ambrose spent a majority of his time in his early years boning up on theology, as we might say. Well, why is he important? Is he just a bishop who got elected under duress or during the Arian controversy? Well, not really. Ambrose, you see, was a real leading theologian in his day. He was widely acclaimed for his rhetorical prowess, or he was a great preacher. In fact, Ambrose was so widely acclaimed that Augustine himself, though still a pagan, had heard about the quality of the speaking of Ambrose there in Milan. And so Augustine went to hear him. And in fact, it was this preaching that eventually led Augustine to the faith. Ambrose did a number of other things as well, but he wasn't just simply the middleman, the midwife, to St. Augustine. He was a notable administrator. He ran a tight ship. He was also very committed to worship, which is the explanation for one of the legends about Ambrose, which is that he is the inventor of antiphonal chant, the call-response monastic song that we're so used to hearing, at least in really bad movies. Ambrose probably didn't invent this. He probably more or less inspired it to become the norm, though. He at least embraced it, and so throughout history he's always been acclaimed as the man who invented it, though, again, this is a bit of revisionist history. One of the more important stories about him, though, was when he stood up to the Emperor Theodosius. Theodosius was a man who actually said very boldly and proudly that he was an Orthodox Christian, that he minced no words.
It is just like Joe Biden. You know, if Theodosius wasn't going around brandishing his Catholic faith and going to, you know, church, you know, everywhere that he goes so the cameras can follow him. Oh, he's so pious. He's so Catholic. No one would have anything to say about Joe Biden. But Joe Biden was just like Theodosius. He wanted to brandish, you know, how Christian he was and how pious he was. And he's the, you know, the church going president, the big guy. He was just like Theodosius.
Boldly and proudly that he was an Orthodox Christian, that he minced no words, and he defended Nicene Orthodoxy in a very aggressive way. Theodosius liked to think of himself as a good Christian emperor. However, he was prone to anger, at least on one occasion, when there were some riots in Thessalonica, and Theodosius sent in the armies and slaughtered several thousand people.
All right, so, I mean, this story, and you should look into it. I don't have time to go all into it, but these barbarians, these German tribes, these Goths, they started penetrating into the empire as they start seeing the empire weakening under Constantine's sons, you know, under Valens. I mean, you had the Battle of Adrianople. They killed Valens, and basically they just had their run of the eastern part of the empire. The barbarians were part of the empire, so the Romans start to make a strategic move to let some of these barbarians, and it's just like today with our border being overrun, you know. There's so many parallels with Rome at that time and how you see the decline in Rome and what's going on in the United States right now. But the not being able to secure the borders from these barbarians. And it's not like these barbarians were coming in and raiding. They were being driven into Roman territory at this time by the Huns. And we're going to talk about the Huns in a moment. But this is what was driving the migrations. When I think about these parallels too, I think about all the crime and the cartels and everything in Central America and Mexico driving the migration up into the United States of America. They're like the Huns. That's the parallel there. The cartels are like the Huns. They were driving, you know, these Germanic tribes into Roman territory, and a lot of these barbarians started to get into the military, the Roman military. A lot of these Roman legions were comprised of these barbarians, and a lot of Theodosius, a lot of his military were these barbarians, and he had some of these barbarian legions in Thessalonica, which is it's the area of Greece. And the crowds there, they revolted against these basically these barbarians who were wearing the Roman uniform representing Rome, but they're foreigners, they're barbarians. So the people there revolted against them. They ended up killing a bunch of them. And then Theodosius, he sends his army into Thessalonica and kills about 7,000 citizens there in Thessalonica. And then he tries to come back to Milan and go to Mass and get communion after, you know, propping himself up as such a pious Christian and doing something like what happened in Thessalonica. And Ambrose said, nah, we're not having it.
Thessalonica. And Theodosius sent in the armies and slaughtered several thousand people as a result. Now, Ambrose is really a friend to Theodosius. Theodosius backed Ambrose in the fight against Arianism. Yet Ambrose had the gall, he had the guts, you might say, to stand up to Theodosius. In fact, he excommunicated him for this act of meting out so much vengeance on so many innocent people rather than merely on the evildoers. And so one of the great artistic representations you have of Ambrose is him staring down the emperor on the steps of the church, barring him admittance even into the community until he says,
no, you can't come in. This just really happened. And a lot of these Catholics that are in support of barring Joe Biden from having communion are referencing this and saying we need more bishops, we need more priests like Ambrose who will stand up to positions of power and say, no, you cannot commit acts of evil and then come into the church and get communion. I want you to listen to a little bit. This is an African bishop, and he's telling this story about Ambrose and Theodosius. And I want you to listen to a little bit of the penance. And this is unheard of. You know, 100 years before this incident that happens in Milan with Ambrose, you know, before 100 years before this, no Roman emperor would have even thought, you know, about wanting to be a part of the Christian church. But I mean, it would have been unheard of for a Christian priest to deny a Roman emperor, and in 390 the Roman Empire is being denied access to the church, denied communion, and I want you to listen to the penance that the Emperor Theodosius does to get back into good graces with the church and to get communion again.
It was a bloodbath. When Ambrose heard about it, he wept. The emperor then attempted to come to Mass, and Ambrose refused to let him in. The emperor was stunned, and Ambrose said, "You have blood on your hands. You may not even enter into the church." The emperor, Theodosius the Great, in all humility, asked for pardon. And Ambrose said that he would have to do the penance, that he would not be allowed to enter the church for a year. This was so, because this crime was so great. And so the emperor went to his palace and wept, fasted, and did the penances for his crime. Rufinus once more appears and says to the emperor that you are the emperor. I will go to Ambrose and I will plead your case. The emperor said, Ambrose is a man of integrity. He will not listen to you. But Rufinus was convinced that he could change the bishop's mind. And so he went to Ambrose, and St. Ambrose refused even to discuss the matter with him. Meanwhile, the emperor is on his way to the church, thinking that Rufinus had in fact succeeded. And so when Rufinus saw what was happening, he went to the emperor and said, Ambrose will not budge. The emperor said, well, I am ready on my way. I will go. And he went to meet St. Ambrose. And St. Ambrose says, I gave orders you not to enter the church. He says, I will not go into the church, but I kneel before you and beg your forgiveness.
I kneel before you and beg your forgiveness. This is a Roman emperor. This is unheard of.
And the Ambrose said, I have already given you the penance. And the emperor said, when David committed his sin, he was forgiven by the prophet. Ambrose responded, David killed one man and shed many tears of repentance. You are responsible for the death of 7,000.
7,000? How many babies are aborted every year? Jeez.
The emperor wept even more and said that give me a penance, my father, give me a penance. And so Ambrose relented and had him to do a public penance where he had to join the penitents, and these were Christians who had committed serious sins, who would stand at the porch of the church, and they would beg for the prayers of those who entered into the church.
You hear this penance? That this is the empire. This is the emperor of the empire on the stairs of the church as people are going into the church to get communion and to go to mass. The emperor is there begging for the prayers and doing penance so he can get into the right standing with the church. And it's a fascinating story, I want you to listen to a little bit more here of this African bishop as he's telling this story and how he himself relates this to Joe Biden. Take a listen.
Today, we have a serious issue where we have American politicians who publicly support, promote abortion, in which not thousands, nor even hundreds of thousands, but millions of human beings made in the image and likeness of God are slaughtered, and they publicly profess it, while at the same time claiming to be Catholic. And we think in particular of Joe Biden, who it seems will be the next president of the United States.
He's president.
He has publicly supported the murder of unborn children made in the image and likeness of God. Not thousands. Theodosius only killed 7,000, but millions. In addition to this, Joe Biden has supported the abomination of same-sex marriage. And all of this, he's professing to be a Catholic. And for some strange reason, there's confusion among the bishops in America as to whether or not he should be admitted to communion. We have a good bishop like Archbishop Cabot, who said no, he should not be admitted to communion because he is out of sync with what the church believes and teaches. And then we have at the other extreme, the cardinal designate, the Archbishop of Washington, Wilton Gregory, who says that he will give Joseph Biden communion. Which of these two is an Ambrose?
Which of these two are an Ambrose or is an Ambrose? Bishop in San Francisco who says that Joe Biden and Nancy Pelosi and anyone who publicly proclaims that they support something that is outside of the teaching of the church, they shouldn't get communion, a bishop like that, or the bishop from Washington, D.C. that says, you know, it doesn't matter who you are or what you do, communion is for everyone. Which one of these is like Ambrose? I'll leave it to you to decide. Well, in the 100 years, the next 100 years after the reign of Theodosius, you start to see the western part of the Roman Empire transform from classical Rome into medieval Rome. The borders are wide open, like the Rio Grande Valley. In 406 and 407, everyone from the German regions, these nomadic German tribes, men, women, and children come across the Danube and Rhine rivers, and they start to settle into the Roman territories. There are no defenses at all, because while these barbarians are coming in to live, you know, they're also, again, they are fleeing the Huns. And when Attila becomes the king of the Huns in the early part of the 5th century, I mean, there's a reason people still talk about Attila today, and none of it is because of anything good. He was terrorizing everyone and pushing these barbarians into Roman territory. But then there was also these barbarian who were militant barbarians who weren't just migrating, the Visigoths, the Vandals, and the limited militaries, and a lot of these militaries made out of German and barbarian armies. These armies were, you know, limited, and they were going around fighting these militant Germanic tribes. And they really couldn't, you know, they didn't have the resources to protect the borders. So everyone was coming in. They were coming in and they were settling in the 100 years after Theodosius, the eternal city of Rome is sacked, by the Vandals and by the Visigoths. It is nearly sacked by Attila and the Huns, but there's this, fantastic story about, Pope Leo, the Bishop of Rome at that time, going out, and this is after Attila had come into Europe and he is, ravaging Europe, and, you know, moving all over Europe, taking what he wants, not being able to be defeated by anyone. And then he comes to Rome, and then the Pope comes out, and big bad Attila, after a meeting with the Pope, turns around and goes back across the Danube River. And, it's the stuff of legends. This, you can't buy publicity like this. People are talking about this for years and years, and this just, adds, these things add to the notoriety and the perception of the Pope that still endures today for a lot of people. The eastern part of the empire, they did try to help the western part of the empire as much as they could, but they had their own problems with the Persians. And then when you get into the 7th century, you're going to have Islam. They're not going to, be able to contribute resources to the western part of the empire. And they had pretty much recited to the fact that the western part of the empire is lost. So these German tribes, these barbarians, start to settle in these western lands that have been basically abandoned by the Romans. They start creating the foundations of what will become the nation states that we even know today. The last Roman emperor who was deposed by a barbarian named Odoacer, his name was Romulus Augustulus. And Romulus Augustulus was deposed by Odoacer for 50 years or even longer than that. Every other emperor in the western part of the empire was either cowering and hiding from the German tribes in Ravenna, or they were just a puppet of the German tribes. And then Odoacer basically says that he's going to end the facade. He deposes Romulus Augustulus, and he declares himself as emperor. He actually sends an envoy to the Eastern Empire with tribute and says, I give you tribute as, this is still the Roman Empire. Like I told you before, these guys, these barbarians that were coming in, they weren't trying to create anything new. They wanted to be Roman. So he sends a envoy to tell the eastern part of the empire that, that I agree that you are the Augustus and I am the Caesar. I submit to you. I'm the new emperor. And he starts to take over. Well, one of these German tribes that came over and settled in the area of Gaul after the last Roman emperor was deposed were the Franks. And the Franks had lived on the boundaries of the Roman Empire for a long time. They had made war with the Romans. They had peace agreements with the Romans. It was a long relationship. And then after they saw that the empire was weakened and the time for them to move deeper into Gaul and settle in Gaul, they started to do that in the late part of the 5th century. And in the beginning of the 6th century, the king of the Franks, a man by the name of Clovis, he converts to Christianity. And it's probably one of the most important conversions in the history of Christianity. The conversion of Paul, the conversion of Constantine, and the conversion of Clovis. I would say these are up there in the top 10 conversions in the history of the Christian religion. And it's important to understand, like I was telling you, a lot of these barbarian tribes were coming into the Roman area and converting into Christianity, but a lot of them were converting into Arianism. And if Clovis would have converted into Arianism, history might have been very different, but he didn't. He converted into Catholic Nicene Christianity, and like I said, it's probably one of the most important conversions in the history of the Christianity and in Western civilization. Take a listen to this clip about the conversion of Clovis.
So Clovis I, he is the grandson of another famous leader who had united these tribes. There are four different tribes living in Gaul at the time. It's in modern-day Western Europe. And in 481, he becomes the leader of the Franks, and he wants to unite these tribes once more. Now, through both marriage and conquest, as you see in front of you, Clovis gains control and unifies all these under the Frankish Empire. Now, the Franks were one of those tribes that Clovis had actually come out of himself, and it's in modern-day France. And he had taken these tribes, had united them, and named the new empire after his original tribe, the Franks. Now, Clovis has a very interesting story because he converts to Christianity in a very similar way that another famous ruler did as well. You might remember back to the Roman Empire and the conversion of Constantine, and if you do remember that story, this story today will sound pretty similar. Here's what Susan Wise Bauer writes about the conversion of Clovis. According to a medieval book called The Chronicle of St. Denis, Clovis converted to Christianity because he wanted God to help him defeat his enemies. Clovis's wife was already a Christian. She had wanted her husband to become a Christian too, but Clovis refused until he fought a great battle against the Alemanni and saw that his men were being slaughtered. So he looked up to heaven. God, he said, I will serve you forever if you will give me the victory. Now the medieval story tells us, instantly his men were filled with burning valor, and a great fear smote his enemies so that they turned their backs and fled the battle. The Alemanni leaders surrendered, and Clovis won the day. As soon as he got home, Clovis went to find a bishop and asked him to explain Christianity. The bishop did, and Clovis agreed to be baptized. Now Clovis, the ex-barbarian, was an emperor and a Christian. Now this is just one of the stories of Clovis's conversion. As we often find with medieval history, there's a lot of conflicting stories here, but this is one of the most prominent ones, that he converts during a battle, much like Constantine did years before him. And it was his wife who, through her conversations with him and trying to encourage him to become a Christian, he eventually does himself. So now, like Bauer says, he's both a Christian and an emperor. Two very important things that are going to come together, and he has a big problem in front of him. He has these four different tribes who are kind of all vying for power, and he needs to unite them. So much like Hammurabi and Justinian, who we've already learned about, he's going to have to find a way to unite these tribes. So he does three things. The first thing he does is he tries to build unity through creating a capital city in Paris. And yes, the same Paris that's the capital of France now. This helps build unity for a city that all of the people of the Franks can look towards as their capital. He also makes Christianity the official religion. Now, we've talked about this before when we talk about religions that become part of a government or a ruling body. And so this doesn't mean that every single person in the Frankish Empire was a Christian. It just meant that they were supposed to be. And that we often find that often many of these people became Christian out of necessity of, you know, wanting to survive or not be thrown in prison, and not necessarily because of any kind of religious belief, although there were many, many devout Christians in this empire. One of the ideas that Clovis had was that if he had all of his followers or the people that he ruled over as one religion, they're hopefully much, much less likely to fight with one another. Now, you and I can probably even look to our culture right outside of our own doors and realize that doesn't actually always happen. But this was a pretty smart idea by Clovis, because it does definitely cut down on some of the divisions. Religion can be a very divisive thing. And so Clovis recognized that and said, well, great, we're all Christians now, so that solves that issue.
All right, so Clovis, like he says here, makes the Franks Christians. And the real impact of Clovis's conversion isn't realized immediately. Like I was just mentioning, the conversion of Paul, the impact of the conversion of Paul was immediate. The impact of the conversion of Constantine was immediate. But the impact of the conversion of Clovis, the real historical impact, is not going to come along for another 250 years after the conversion of Clovis. But the fact that Clovis converted and converted all the Franks to the Nicene, actually Chalcedonian Creed, which confirms the Nicene Creed, that there is one God with two distinct natures, a human nature, Jesus was God in human form, and a divine nature. This is the Christianity that Clovis, that he embraced, and there were a lot, even himself, he was very interested. The guy in the clip that we just played even mentioned that Clovis's wife was a Christian while he was still pagan, and she's the one who kind of influenced him to embrace Catholic Nicene Christianity and not the Arian Christianity. Like I said, things would have been very different if Clovis would have become an Arian, but his wife was a Catholic Nicene Christian, and that is the Christianity that Clovis that he converted into, and it becomes very, very important 250 years later. So with that, let's move ahead to about 150 years from the conversion of Clovis. And let's step away from Europe into the Arabian desert, and let's talk about the birth of Islam. Before we talk about the birth of Islam, I want to read this this passage from the Paul's epistle to the church of Galatia, the book of Galatians. And this is the first chapter of the book of Galatians. And Paul says to the church of Galatians, I'm astonished that you are so quickly deserting the one who called you to live in the grace of Christ and are turning to a different gospel. He's talking about heresy. Like I told you in the last podcast, that and we talked about, and I read the passage of Jesus telling the parable of the wheat and the tares, and I related it to heresy. I told you that heresy was a part of the Christian church from the very beginning, and this is Paul writing this letter to the church at Galatia, and talking to them about a different gospel, a heresy. that they are starting to believe, and this is even in the first century. Jesus, he warned his disciples and the church about many things, but one of the main things that Jesus continued to warn his followers about was deception, and deception being the biggest threat to the church and his followers. And this is the Apostle Paul writing this letter to the church of Galatia saying, hey, you guys are not believing the same gospel that I preach to you, and you're turning to a different gospel. And he says, which is really not a gospel at all. It's a copycat. It's not authentic. Evidently, some people are throwing you into confusion and are trying to pervert the gospel of Christ. And then he says, but even if an angel from heaven should preach a gospel other than the one we have preached, let them be under God's curse. In the King James, it says anathema. So he says this part right here, even if an angel from heaven should preach another gospel from the one that we've preached, let them be under God's curse, anathema. And he's saying that, you know, it doesn't matter who is coming to you and teaching another gospel, a heresy. If it's different from the gospel that we, the apostles, have taught you, then it's a heresy. And it doesn't matter who's teaching it, even if it comes from an angel. And this is very important because most of the people he's writing to in this first century are Jewish Christians. And these Jewish Christians, you know, to them, an angel appearing to deliver a message from God, that was something that they understood and had heard about before. An angel appeared to Daniel. An angel appeared to Mary and Joseph. And often it was the same angel. If you go through the scriptures and you see an angel appearing with a message from God, it's usually this angel whose name is Gabriel. There's only a few angels in the Bible who are named by name, and Gabriel is one of them, the archangel Michael, Lucifer. But Gabriel is the one who is usually coming and delivering a message from God. And Paul is saying, even if an angel comes and delivers a message, a gospel that is different from the one that I have preached to you, let them be a curse, anathema. All right, so let's start talking about Muhammad and the birth of Islam in the 7th century. And Muhammad was visited. That's why I tell you this story about this letter to Galatia, is because Muhammad was visited by an angel, and everything that is in Islam, everything in the Quran, comes from what Muhammad got from this angel. Very much like Mormonism. If you know Mormonism and Islam, they both start the same way. They both have so many parallels, Islam and Mormonism. Joseph Smith is everything that comes from Mormonism comes from Joseph Smith. Joseph Smith is visited by angels, the angel Moroni, and Moroni tells him where to find these plates, and there's no witnesses. Everything comes from these individuals, from Joseph Smith and from Muhammad. And, you know, that I like to say, what do the Quran, the Book of Mormon, and Dianetics have in common? What do the Book of Mormon, the Quran, and Dianetics have in common? And the answer is that they all come from the mind of a single individual or from the mouth of a single individual. L. Ron Hubbard, Muhammad, and Joseph Smith. Now, you can't say that about Christianity and Jesus. Like Christianity comes from Judaism. There's tons of witnesses and different people who testify to the same thing. You don't have just one apostle. You have 12 that are writing, that are testifying, that are being martyred for their testimony. Yeah, I mean, Jesus doesn't write anything. He doesn't. He doesn't leave a book or anything. You have people writing about him, testifying about him, that become the foundation of the Christian church. But Islam, it comes from one individual, and it comes from Muhammad, and it comes from a revelation and a encounter that he claims to have had alone in a cave with the angel Gabriel. And it just happens to be this angel Gabriel that every time there is an appearance from an angel in the Gospels, in the Old Testament Jewish text, it's always this angel Gabriel. And it just happens to be this angel Gabriel that meets Muhammad in this cave and starts to give him revelations in the 7th century. This is a clip about the people who make annual pilgrimages to this cave, to this day where Muhammad went and got his first revelations from the angel Gabriel.
In the shadows of the pilgrimage rituals that focused on Mecca lies a place on the outskirts of the city. All Muslims know about it, but very few go there. Step by step, dozens climb up the mountain of flight, 600 steps. For the athletically fit, the climb could take 30 minutes, but for most people, the journey could take close to 2 hours, all this just to see the Cave of Hira.
That's not just any cave, it's the birthplace of Islam. Muhammad used to leave Mecca and come here to meditate. From this cave, the first teaching of Islam came to light.
Muslims believe that in this place, God sent the Archangel Gabriel ordering Muhammad to recite or read. After this incident 1,400 years ago, Muhammad started preaching. So this cave was the spark that made nearly 23% of the world's population Muslims.
That's not why 23% of the population are Muslims. Not because of what went on in that cave.
The world's population Muslims.
I am 55 years old, so I feel great making it to the top. The cave is a witness to a series of successes leading to over 1.5 billion Muslims and the world's biggest mosques. Seeing how small this cave is makes me realize the greatness of this religion.
He says seeing how small the cave is makes him realize how great the religion is. And it is a small cave. It makes me wonder, you know, how big was this angel that could fit into this small cave? But he claims that it was the angel Gabriel. There's several reasons why I don't believe that it's the same Gabriel that is talked about in the Bible. One of them is because when Gabriel comes to Mary and tells her she's going to be with child, she's afraid, just like Muhammad is afraid. And Muhammad continues in fear. But the Gabriel, when he approaches Mary in the New Testament, he says, you know, don't be afraid. Fear not, is what he says. The other thing, too, is Mary and Muhammad both began to worship the angel Gabriel. And in the New Testament, Gabriel tells every time that he appears to someone in the Bible, he tells them, you know, don't worship me. I mean, he doesn't allow them to worship him. Muhammad worships this angel, Gabriel, that he meets in this little hole in the mountain. And this is where the religion started. This is where he gets his first revelation. But Muhammad continues getting revelations for the rest of his life, and continues having encounters with this angel Gabriel. It's not just a one-time event where he comes to him in this cave. He continues to get these, like, download these revelations. I'm on his Wikipedia page, and it's really interesting. There's this part here where they're talking about how he would get these revelations. Hold on, I want to read this to you. It says, Aisha reported, quote, I saw Prophet being inspired divinely on a very cold day and noticed the sweat dropping from his forehead. So it's a cold day, and he starts to sweat, and he just goes into this kind of shake or whatever, and he's getting a download. He's getting he's downloading a new revelation. It says right here, Muhammad was confident that he could distinguish his own thoughts from these messages. So the revelations continued, the interactions with Gabriel continues. There's the story of Isra. If you remember when President Obama went to Egypt right after being elected president, and he's going to give his address to the Muslim world, he actually quotes this story of Isra. I'll take a listen to Obama here.
Everyone knows to be true. Too many tears have been shed. Too much blood has been shed. All of us have a responsibility to work for the day when the mothers of Israelis and Palestinians can see their children grow up without fear. When the holy land of the three great faiths is the place of peace that God intended it to be. When Jerusalem is a secure and lasting home for Jews and Christians and Muslims, and a place for all of the children of Abraham to mingle peacefully together, as in the story of Isra. As in the story of Isra, when Moses, Jesus, and Muhammad, peace be upon them, joined in prayer.
This story of Isra, when Moses, Jesus, and Muhammad joined. What kind of Christian would even quote this story? But the story of Isra is the story of in I think it was 621 is when this happens, and the angel Gabriel takes Muhammad from Mecca. He's in the mosque there in Mecca, and the angel Gabriel takes him on this horse all the way from Mecca to Jerusalem in a single night. And from there, Gabriel takes right there where the Dome of the Rock is. This story is why the Dome of the Rock is where it is right now on the Jewish temple, ruins of the Jewish temple, is because of this story of Isra, where Gabriel takes Muhammad on the night journey to the very spot where the Dome of the Rock is on the ruins of the Jewish temple. And Muhammad goes to the sky, and God is there, and Jesus is there, and Moses is there, and Muhammad's there, and God tells Muhammad that Jesus was my former prophet. I have no need for Jesus anymore. I have no need for the Old Testament prophets. Muhammad, you're the prophet now, and there's no God but God, and Muhammad, you're the prophet now. He's basically, so think about all these debates that are going on in Europe, around Arianism and the nature of God and who Jesus is, despite that Jesus even said himself that he was God, that's why he was killed. But, you know, Muhammad's coming around with this new doctrine, this new gospel, and he's grafting Islam into Judaism, going all the way back to Abraham. We're going to listen to a clip in a moment, and with the former Muslim tell you what Muslims believe about Abraham and Abraham's lineage through Ishmael or Isaac. And Muhammad is just like Joseph Smith, quite frankly. Everything, if you really understand Mormonism and everything, like the head guy in Mormonism is called the Prophet. He's kind of like the Pope of Mormonism. He's called the Prophet. The building where in Utah is called the Temple, the Mormon Temple, and they have a tabernacle. It's all from Judaism. So Muhammad's doing the same thing. He's grafting himself into Judaism, and basically. That's what the story of Isra is. That's where all of this stuff comes from. That's why the angel Gabriel is even relevant, because that is an angel that is important in Judaism and in Christianity. So, of course, it was the angel Gabriel. I want you to listen to this clip. This is a Muslim. I want you to hear them in their own words tell this story about how Muhammad started getting these revelations. Take a listen.
And when he reached the age of 38, 39, the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam had a very interesting experience. He started to see dreams at night. He started to have dreams at night. And what would happen is the next day, the dream would come true.
I mean, how could you? You got to stop this. How could you know that? Besides me telling you with my, you're not there. There's no one else there in my dream. And if something happens that is, you know, the next day and I wake up and I say, oh, you know what? I dreamed that last night. How would anybody know if you're lying or not about the fact that you say, oh, what just happened is what I dreamed last night?
Many people believe Joseph. Dum, 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 dum.
I swear, it's hilarious.
Like whatever he saw in his dream would occur in the next day. And then, so the first time you're like, okay. Then the second time, third time, fourth time, and it became a daily event.
It's a daily event. Second time, third time. Hey, you see what just happened? I dreamed that last night.
Ar-ru'ya as-sadiqa. And that was to get him to just kind of trust his heart, to be comfortable with having knowledge, with being given knowledge that was not available, was not possible to be attained anywhere else. And once that started to happen, then he really started to reflect and deep think, think very deeply. And that's when the Prophet ﷺ decided, I need to kind of get some time away. I need some time to reflect. I need some time to just invest into just some deep thought, deep reflection. Get away from the noise. And that's when he tells his wife, and he's been telling her, I have these dreams, and whatever I see comes true the next day. And she tells him, don't worry, just trust your heart. Everything has a purpose and a reason. Then he comes to her and tells her, I need some time to reflect, to think. I need to get away for a little bit. And she says, absolutely. How long do you need to go for? At least a couple of days. I'm going to go find a nice spot in the mountains, not too far away. But I need a secluded, nice spot where I can go and I can reflect. She packs them together, some food, some supplies, some clothes, and sends them off very lovingly. And the Prophet ﷺ goes outside of Mecca, finds a mountain by the name of Nur, Jabal Nur. And there he finds a small cave by the name of Hira, Ghar Hira. And he actually chose that spot because when he sat at the mouth of the cave, he could see the Kaaba from there.
Now we're going to talk about the Kaaba here in a moment. But I want to get back to these downloads, these revelations that Muhammad continued to get from Gabriel for the rest of his life, because in the early part of Muhammad's ministry, these revelations were peaceful, and it was, you know, he was really, you know, trying to use honey instead of vinegar. You know, he was really the revelations. I mean, when people talk about Islam being a religion of peace, and they take you to the Quran, they're going to take you to those early days when Muhammad first started getting these revelations in Mecca and started teaching in Mecca. And it was all about peace and love. And then he is run off from Mecca. He goes to Medina. And then Medina, he starts to really, his message starts to really take root. And he starts to build his following in Medina. And the revelations start to change quite a bit. There's this incident in Medina. I have a clip here. I'm going to let this guy, we're going to listen to a couple of clips from this guy, and then we'll probably wrap it up. But he calls himself the apostate prophet. He is a former Muslim, and you know, everything that he says checks out. I want you to take a listen.
The Banu Qurayza were a tribe of Jews who lived in what is now known as Medina. Back then it was called Yathrib. For better understanding, I will simply refer to it as Medina. In order to understand the Banu Qurayza massacre better, let's get some context on the background. Medina was already inhabited by Jews long before Muhammad arrived. We know that Jews came to Medina as a superior culture. They established economic stability in the Arab regions they came to, and were dominant until other Arab tribes arrived and secured political dominance over Jews. But at some point, the Arab tribes of Medina fell into a large conflict, and that conflict destroyed the political stability of Medina. Muhammad's home was Mecca, but in the 620s, after Muhammad tried preaching his religion in Mecca, and the population rejected it firmly, scared of being killed by angry locals, Muhammad looked for a new home, and found it in Medina. First, some of his followers spread Islam in Medina, then his followers settled there, and afterwards Muhammad migrated to Medina. The Medinan Arab tribes were interested in Muhammad settling in Medina because they had large conflicts and believed Muhammad, with his new message, could end those conflicts. He could secure the controlling of Jews and make Medina stronger, stronger than Mecca. They were right. Muhammad was brought to Medina as leader by the Arabs, not by the uninvolved Jews. But when Muhammad arrived in Mecca, in order to end the conflicts and secure political unity, Muhammad made a constitution for Medina. That constitution ensured that all people in Medina help each other, and the constitution also mentioned the Jews in the city. He intended with this constitution to collect the people of Medina and to ensure that despite their religious differences, everyone is one and has to defend the city of Medina. We don't find any credible source on whether the Jews agreed to that, but historians mostly find that the three greater Jewish tribes, Qurayza, Nadir, and Kainuka, never agreed to this treaty, but were listed as client tribes instead. Some historians think they were given a separate agreement at a later time that was similar or identical to relevant parts of the constitution. But things were initially peaceful. In this proclamation, one thing was clear. The Jews in Medina were to help the Muslims in case of a fight with the polytheist Meccans. Jews were not allowed to help besieging polytheists and were not allowed to take them into the city. Meanwhile, Muhammad tried to spread Islam further and invite the Jews to Islam as well. But Jews largely rejected Muhammad and Islam, and so did the Jews of Medina, who considered Islam a ripoff of their religion and their culture. Initially, Muhammad wanted to ensure religious freedom and unity for everyone, until the Jews strictly rejected him. But further on, things didn't go very well. In the following 5 years, from 622 to 627, the Jewish tribes of Medina completely disappeared. Not voluntarily, of course. First the Banu Qaynuqa tribe was expelled, then the Banu Nadir. According to Islamic reports, the Banu Qaynuqa tribe was expelled because the Jews harassed a Muslim woman, then a Muslim killed the harassing Jew, then the Muslim was killed by the Jews, then the Jews killed the Muslim. And this conflict went on until Muhammad declared war on the Banu Qaynuqa tribe. Muhammad defeated them and wanted to exterminate them. But a Medinan Arab chief who liked the Kainuka tribe begged Muhammad to let them live and didn't understand Muhammad's fury. So Muhammad expelled them instead. This is an important point. When Muslim apologists talk about the Banu Qurayza massacre, they point out correctly that Muhammad didn't exterminate the first two Jewish tribes, but only expelled them. But Islamic sources themselves say that Muhammad did want to massacre those Jews, but someone else was more reasonable than Muhammad and prevented this massacre by begging. About the Banu Nadir tribe, it gets even weirder. According to reports, Muhammad had to pay blood money in a conflict that happened recently, and he needed funds from the Banu Nadir tribe as well, and the Banu Nadir initially agreed to that. But Muhammad apparently received divine inspiration that the Banu
download,
Nadir tribe...
The download!
But Muhammad apparently received divine inspiration that the Banu Nadir tribe wanted to assassinate him instead. So he approached them, asked them to leave the city, and when they refused, Muhammad attacked them and eventually defeated and expelled them. Many historians, especially Orientalists, think that the reason behind these expulsions was different, because the Islamic sources are very vague and don't give us anything of value. The Jews were merchants and had therefore relations with many other towns and tribes. And they were critical of Islam and mostly collectively rejected Muhammad and made that publicly clear. According to many historians, this is why Muhammad actively looked for reasons to get rid of these Jews. Another interesting point is that according to Ibn Ishaq's biography of Muhammad, he wanted to massacre both of these tribes, and in both cases, it was prevented by human or divine intervention. We see here that massacre was the first option for Muhammad. He just loved it, I guess. But there was one tribe left, the Banu Qurayza, who remained neutral during all these conflicts.
So do you understand what's going on here? That Muhammad has this new revelation, this new message from the Jewish God. And when he starts preaching this first in Mecca, hey, the Jewish God told me that I'm the new prophet and his last prophet, and there's no God but God, and all of these downloads, these revelations that he's getting from Gabriel. He starts teaching that and preaching that in Mecca, and it's all about, you know, peace and love. And then they chase him off and he goes to Medina. When he gets into Medina, he starts preaching the same message and he starts getting a following. But there's a lot of Jews that live in the area around Medina. And he even starts approaching them and says, hey, yeah, you know, your God says that Moses isn't the prophet you look to anymore. Your God said that I'm the prophet that you look to now. And the Jews are like, what are you talking about? You know, so he's trying to hijack Judaism, but he's got actual Jews living there amongst him in Medina, and he's trying to sell this new religion to them, and they're not hearing that. They don't have anything to do with it. So he is plotting to get rid of these Jews, because you can't have the authentic Jews there while you're trying to impersonate Jews with your new religion. And these guys who are authentic Jews, who, you know, are circumcised, who can date their culture back 3,000 years. You're trying to impersonate them. He had to get rid of them. And then so he expels the two of the Jewish tribes, and this story about this massacre of he kills over 700 Jews. And I'm telling you all this because I want you to understand that it's when that the Muhammad in Mecca, when he first starts his ministry, is a totally different Muhammad than in Medina, when he has a huge following and a bunch of power. The revelations again start to change. Everything starts to change. He starts to become more militant, and he starts to enforce Islam on by the tip of a sword. And it's no different from what's going on in Europe. You know, people like to say, well, Islam was spread by the tip of a sword. Do you know anything about how Charlemagne conquered Saxony, We're going to talk about that, the Saxon Wars. I mean, the tip of Christianity is as violent as Islam, especially medieval Christianity. But what I'm explaining to you about Islam is that the prophet of Islam, the roots of Islam, start in this violence, and you can't say the same thing about Christianity. The prophet of Christianity, the center of Christianity, gave his life. He didn't take anyone's life. So let's listen to a little bit more of this guy. This is a different video, and he explains the Kaaba, because the Kaaba is the center of Islam. Everything in Islam comes down to this particular spot on the planet Earth where the Kaaba is. If you know anything about the pilgrimage to Mecca, they go there every year for Hajj, and they do the march around this big black cube. This big black cube was there in the 7th century. This is where Muhammad, when he leaves Medina to come back into Mecca with his huge army, he conquers Mecca. He comes in and they slaughter a bunch of people in Mecca. They come to the Kaaba. He's going to say it here. I don't need to tell you. He's going to tell you right now.
The Islamic belief on the origins of the Kaaba are very different from what an objective non-Islamic research finds. According to Islamic belief, the Kaaba was built by Abraham, the forefather of Abrahamic religion, and he was told to build it by Allah. That is made very clear in Quran chapter 22, verse 26. Muslims believe that Ishmael, Abraham's first son, was given the blessing of the Kaaba so that his descendants would make an annual pilgrimage and a sacrifice feast at the Kaaba. Muslims believe that Ishmael was Abraham's religiously important and chosen son.
Can you imagine trying to convert Jews, coming into Medina from Mecca and trying to convert Jews to your new religion with this story that hey, your father Abraham, who you guys have been worshiping for thousands of years, thinking that that Moses was an important prophet, and that Isaac was the heir to Abraham, and Sarah was his wife, and you're coming into Medina and you're trying to convert Jews by saying that Moses isn't important, Isaac isn't important, and Hagar, because she was the mother of Ishmael, she's now important. Imagine trying to convert Jews with this story.
God chose Isaac, not Ishmael. Ishmael is described as a warrior and not the one who inherits his father's legacy. He's seen among many Jews as wicked but repentant, while Christians simply see him as Abraham's other wicked son. It is quite weird that Arab Muslims would make such a change in the biblical narrative and belief, and afterwards claim that Jews and Christians falsified the Bible. There are more differences than that.
Actually, they actually believe, they tell the story of Abraham going to the mountain and God, because remember, God told Abraham, if you don't know this story, God told Abraham after Isaac was born to take Isaac to this mountain and sacrifice him, and then when Abraham is going and following God's orders, he's about to sacrifice his promised son, the promised son that God has promised him. He's about to sacrifice him, and God stops him and says, no, you know, it was a test. And the Muslims tell the same story, but it was Ishmael that this happened to and not Isaac. So this is the story that Muhammad was telling when he's coming into Medina trying to convert these Jews.
Arab Muslims would make such a change in the biblical narrative and belief, and afterwards claim that Jews and Christians falsified the Bible. There are more differences than that, such as that Ishmael's mother Hagar, who is Abraham's handmaiden in the Bible, is suddenly directly Abraham's second wife in Islam. These changes appear probably because Arabs assume that they are descendants of Ishmael, while Jews are descendants of Isaac. But more to that at another time. Let's come back to the Kaaba. According to Islamic belief, Abraham built the Kaaba, Ishmael took care of it, and over generations it was revered by prophets and believers as Allah's house. That's why Muslims call it Baytullah, which means house of Allah. In the Quran it is also mentioned as sacred house, revered house, and so on. The black stone at one corner of the Kaaba is also believed to have been placed there by Abraham. But at the time of Muhammad, the Kaaba was held holy by Arab pagans, not by Christians and Jews. Muslims and some scholars close to Islam also claim that Christians and Jews regularly paid respect to the Kaaba, but there is no such evidence.
There's no evidence of that at all. There's nothing in the Torah, which are the oldest Jewish texts, about Abraham. It's where we know anything about Abraham. There's nothing about the Kaaba in any of those old Jewish texts. And this is supposed to be another part of the Jewish religion, is what Islam is. This is, again, this is a play on Judaism.
Muslims and some scholars close to Islam also claim that Christians and Jews regularly paid respect to the Kaaba, but there is no such evidence. As for how the Kaaba became a pagan site, Muslims explain that people became over time inclined towards polytheism and idolatry, which would explain why there were idols in the Kaaba during Muhammad's time. But the Kaaba, according to Islamic sources, was nevertheless dedicated to one god and was also a very important site, because Mecca was a trade center that was visited by people of all kinds of beliefs. Again, according to Islamic tradition and belief, Muhammad started preaching at the Kaaba once he declared his prophethood. And after he was driven out of Mecca and fled to Medina, he came back again to conquer Mecca, and then he entered the Kaaba, destroyed all idols belonging to the pagans, let it clean out, and dedicated it again only to Allah. The destruction of other people's
Allah was actually one of the gods in this pantheon of gods. So what the Kaaba was during this time when Muhammad was driven out of Mecca, it was Mecca was a trading post. People would come from all over the Arabian desert to buy supplies, to trade, you know, to mingle, all of those things. And the Kaaba was a place where it was a pantheon of gods, where all these different people, they could go to this spot called the Kaaba, and they could worship their god. And there were many gods in there, and Allah was actually one of the gods in this pantheon. And Muhammad raised Allah to be the supreme God, the God of the Jews. And when he comes back from Medina into Mecca, they come in, and with a large army, they kill a bunch of people. They go to the Kaaba. He destroys all the other gods besides Allah and dedicates the Kaaba to Allah. Let's listen to a little bit more here. And
out and dedicated it again only to Allah. The destruction of other people's holy artifacts by Muhammad is ironically not seen as an aggression by Muslims. It is seen as a just cause because Muhammad claimed the Kaaba for Allah, his own God. Imagine founding a new religion, going to Mecca, destroying the Kaaba, building your own temple there instead, and saying, well, that's what my God told me. Imagine the Islamic outcry if that happened. Anyway, that's a summary of...
This is that's just the beginning. That's like all the... I mean, reason I'm telling you this story, because I'm going to be telling you about the political aspects of Islam after Muhammad dies, and these Muslims, they spill out of the Arabian desert. They start taking over Africa. They start taking over all this Roman territory that is in Palestine, the area of Syria, all the way up to Turkey, and they set their eyes on the Roman capital city of Byzantium, Constantinople. And today, just like when Muhammad in the 7th century marched into into Mecca with his sword and made Mecca Islamic city. That was just the first. This is going to happen over and over again. After Muhammad dies, Muslims are going to march in with their armies, and they're going to declare their cities, their churches, their whatever are going to be Islamic, and they're going to create an entire philosophy around it. And we'll talk about it moving forward. Let's listen to a little bit more of this guy, and then I'm going to play us out.
Islamic view on the origins of the Kaaba. Now let's come to the non-Islamic, more realistic view. First off, as mentioned at the beginning, Muslims pray towards the Kaaba because the Quran says so, and because Muhammad did so. But that wasn't always true. When Muhammad began his prophecy, he wouldn't pray towards the Kaaba, but towards Jerusalem. Coincidentally, Jews pray towards Jerusalem too. They call it Mizrah instead of Qibla. Mizrah stands for east and stands for the direction of Jerusalem from the Jewish diaspora's perspective. Jews also used to pray towards Jerusalem when Muhammad was alive, and there were lots of them in and around Mecca. From an objective point of view, it looks very much like Muhammad started the prayer direction thing because Jews did the same thing, and he claimed that his religion came from the same origins. Now, the direction of the prayer suddenly changed at some time, and turned from Jerusalem towards Kaaba. According to early Islamic historian Tabari, who wrote a biography of Muhammad, Jews would mock Muhammad for using the same direction to pray, because Muhammad was hostile to them when they rejected his message, which sounded ridiculous to most of them. The theory that the direction changed because Jews mocked him becomes even clearer if you read the Quran. In chapter 2 of the Quran literally responds to people mocking Muhammad for his practice, then announces the change, and justifies it because it says that the first direction towards Jerusalem was only a test for the believers.
And he's given all of the, I'll put this guy's video in the show notes. He's giving all the references in the Quran that reference all of these things taking place. Muhammad being mocked, Muhammad changing the direction of the prayer towards the Kaaba. This is why Muslims to this day have to be facing east towards the Kaaba, no matter where they are. Went down to the beach here in California a couple of weeks ago, and there were a group of Muslims facing east and praying. It's because they're praying towards the Kaaba.
Was only a test for the believers. Muslims prayed towards Jerusalem for years before it changed. What test was that? What was the purpose? I'm really curious. How does that test your belief? Only the history of the Muslim Qibla, the direction of the prayer, makes Islam look extremely ridiculous in its own sources. But let's come to the history of the Kaaba. As a side note, it is important to point out that pre-Islamic Arabia was extremely underdeveloped and primitive. Literature had no big importance, and written texts basically didn't exist. That's why it's really hard to find out anything about pre-Islamic history, and many people are forced to read the biased Islamic view. Islamic sources claim that Abraham built the Kaaba for Allah and designated it as a place for current Islamic practices, like circling it, fasting, sacrificing animals, and so on. It is declared to be the most important thing about Abraham, one of the most important things to Allah. The problem is that the Bible never mentioned the Kaaba. Now, Islam claims that Allah is the same God of the Bible. But if all of this is really the way Islam tells us, then why was the Kaaba never mentioned in the Bible? Why was it never mentioned in Jewish traditions, in the Talmud? Why was it not held important among Christians at all? The Quran even claims that Allah gave Abraham the mission to instate practices like circling the Kaaba or sacrificing. But Christians and Jews don't do such a thing.
They never have. These questions that he's raising, they're so explosive. I mean, they destroy Islam, in fact. The Kaaba is the most important thing to Islam. So important that in the United States of America, you find Muslims on a beach in San Diego, California, facing towards the Kaaba to pray. Every Muslim in every part of the world is facing towards this thing. It is the center of Islam, and it is supposed to be something that was given by Abraham, and it is supposed to be connected to Abraham, and you can't find a whiff of this in the Torah. You can't find a whiff of it. No mention of the Kaaba. It destroys Islam. It just destroys it, in my point of view. Well, after Muhammad dies, Muslims start to spill out of Arabia. You have the split between the Sunni and the Shia that takes place after Muhammad dies. Abu Bakr is Muhammad's lieutenant and second in command when Muhammad dies, and he becomes the new leader of the Islamic hordes. And there is the nephew of Muhammad, Ali, who there's a faction that believes that Ali should secede Muhammad. And that's where you get the two different Islamic religions, the Sunni and the Shia. The Sunni basically take off and start going towards Africa and, you know, spilling out, you know, to all areas of the world. And the Shia mainly stay towards the east. We're going to talk about the implications of all of this in the next podcast. As the Muslims come out of the Arabian Desert and start conquering North Africa, all of these territories that were formerly Roman territories, they are even going to penetrate Europe in the area of Spain and create a whole civilization there. And they're going to attempt to push into Europe, into France. They're going to meet up with these Franks that I told you about, and we're going to talk about what happens there in the next episode. And with that, I hope you've enjoyed this episode. I hope you have a wonderful 4th of July, and I'll be back with episode 94 as soon as possible. I hope you guys have been enjoying the podcast and all the history. I'm going to leave you with this video of Mark Dice. I don't know if you've ever heard of Mark Dice, but he is a YouTuber and author. His early things that he would do would go out with the, you know how Jay Leno sends someone out on the streets of Los Angeles with the microphone and ask people questions. That's what Mark Dice started off doing in the beginning of him being known. And he just did this recent video going back to an oldie but goodie. He's done this video before, but the one that I'm going to play for you here in a moment is recent. And he just goes to the beach here in San Diego, goes down to the beach, and he just starts asking people about why we celebrate the 4th of July. And I'm going to leave you with this, and we'll be back with episode...
Celebrating 4th of July?
94.
Yes, I do.
And what do we celebrate on the 4th of July?
Independence.
What started it?
I'm not too sure.
No. Long time ago, history class, 5th grade, they said something started this whole 4th of July celebration. What was it?
I'm guessing, like, winning them over freedom in America, maybe?
I don't know.
You don't know?
I'm not sure.
Then you're not sure?
I'm not sure.
It started because we broke away from a certain country, right?
Yeah.
Right. What country was that?
I gotta go, man.
You don't know. What country did we declare independence from to create this great country?
This is bad. This is bad of me.
Ready for the 4th of July?
Yeah, we are.
What country did we declare independence from?
America. I forgot, man.
What's that?
I forgot.
You forgot? Okay. What year was the Declaration of Independence signed?
1856 or 1756.
1756.
Maybe.
When John Wilkes Booth and Karl Marx signed the Declaration of Independence to start this country, what year was that?
1492.
Well, that is a date in history, but it's not the when there was a certain document that was signed that started this country. What was that?
I don't remember when the Declaration of Independence was signed. It's probably 1600s somewhere.
When Lee Harvey Oswald and Karl Marx signed the Declaration of Independence to start this great country, what year was that?
I'm assuming the 1800s.
You're just assuming.
Yeah, anything I don't else? Know. I'm not a history person.
Obviously.
I don't remember, honestly.
No.
No.
Could you guess?
Can I guess? Maybe 1815? Does that sound right? Maybe?
No.
14 something?
Sounds wrong. It is wrong.
Yeah, so are you going to tell me?
Other than Karl Marx and John Wilkes Booth, who are some of the other founding fathers that are credited with starting this great country?
Benjamin Franklin... Abraham Lincoln, right?
No, he was way, way after.
Okay, well, Benjamin Franklin.
Okay, you got one. When Sean Hannity and Rush Limbaugh signed the Declaration of Independence, what year was that?
I don't know.
Did you go to history class?
Yeah, and I aced it, but I don't remember most stuff. It's like, because I can...